Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of my Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and Jasmine Smith is not here today, but we have two people to replace her, because Jasmine can't be replaced by just one person. So today, we have Ethan Epping. Ethan is a Northern Kentucky native. He's a Centre College graduate, and he's a recovering campaign staffer, having spent the past 5 years working on state and national Democratic campaigns. He worked for candidates such as President Obama, Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe, Allison Lundergan Grimes when she ran for Senate here in Kentucky, and most recently he was the Director of Data and Analytics for the Clinton campaign in Iowa. Ethan's new to Louisville. He moved here earlier this year, and now he works for Roadmap, recently acquired. Congratulations.
Thank you, Robert.
What Roadmap does, they help to identify and reduce low-value and unnecessary health care. He's also been spending his free time working with a number of local Democratic organizations, including Kentucky Democratic Party, the Jefferson County Democratic Committee, and the newly rebooted Louisville Young Democrats. Ethan Epping, welcome to my Wotech podcast.
Thank you so much, Robert.
Yeah, glad to have you here. And Carmen Mitchell is here. Carmen is here today to talk to us a little bit about the Kentucky Initiative, which is something that I'm really excited to talk about. That organization exists to recruit and support new candidates for the Kentucky House of Representatives, but Carmen herself is the fundraising director for the organization. In addition to working on bringing donations to the organization, Carmen builds and cultivates relationships with members of the community and constituency groups who have traditionally not had a large voice or presence in state politics. Carmen also is a full-time doctoral student in the Department of Health Management at UofL, Global Public Health, which means she's smarter than us. And she also works as a graduate research assistant in both her department and the Department of Health Promotion. Before that, she was a development associate at UofL at the School of Medicine. Her first foray into Kentucky politics came when she interned with State Representative Joni Jenkins, friend of the pod, several years ago in her Louisville office at JCTC, where they worked on policy and government for at-risk and foster youth in Louisville. We talked to her about that when she was on the show. That was a cool program, and Jasmine was really excited about it because she's really into that. Welcome to the show, Carmen.
Thank you so much for having me, Robert.
Yeah, really excited to have you both here. All right, well, let's go ahead and get started by talking a little bit about the Kentucky Initiative. Like we mentioned earlier, Carmen works for the Kentucky Initiative, and like we said, they are working to recruit people to run for the State House of Representatives in Kentucky, specifically Democrats and specifically progressive Democrats. So, you know, people who listen to the show or pay attention to Kentucky politics know that the Democrats lost the House of Representatives last year, which was a major blow to Kentucky Democrats. So, Carmen, can you talk to me a little bit about what types of candidates and what kind of seats the initiative is targeting to regain the chamber?
Absolutely. And thank you so much again for the introductions. What we have been focusing on as far as bringing people into the process is really looking for folks who are outside of what we call the political industrial complex. Gosh. So when you think of your traditional political candidates, the people you normally envision are the kind of folks who were running for school government in high school and college, went to law school, maybe started clerking, working for a law office, or started a business, and then they worked in some form of politics for a long time, and then it was kind of their turn to run. Mm-hmm. And that's generally the image you think of when you think of politicians. But what that does is it makes a lot of other folks who are really interested in the political process or feel like they can make a difference but haven't been part of that process feel like they are left out and can't be the political candidate themselves. And we're really trying to break down that barrier. Mm-hmm. So we're a group of normal folks who are not politicians. So we all, after the election, a lot of us, we started
the 2016 election.
The 2016, right. Mm-hmm. Yes. So a lot of us were already involved in some shape or form. Maybe we volunteered for campaigns or did other things, but we weren't really working in that capacity. Mm-hmm. But we're all concerned about Kentucky. And even before the 2016 election, so thinking back to 2015 after Matt Bevin won the governor's
uh-huh,
office,
sure.
And thinking back to Allison Lundergan Grimes' loss.
Mm-hmm. You know, in the Senate.
Been,
mm-hmm.
Absolutely. There's been a lot of concern just in general about the state of Kentucky politics. But
uh-huh.
What we want to focus on is specifically the House and getting everyday folks, your neighbors, mm-hmm. who work at maybe your local plant or who, you know, work as a teacher at a school district, mm-hmm. other people besides
who you
lawyers.
Normally would see.
Absolutely.
Right, yeah, lawyers. That's probably,
yeah.
It's
which lawyers can be fine people. I know yeah. some, so
yeah.
I don't want anybody to.
you know, Jasmine's a lawyer, so you're lucky she's not here today.
Right.
right. Okay. So talk to me a little bit about the type of, is it just like anywhere you can find somebody that wants to run, you'll support them, or are you targeting specific districts?
Well, we definitely have a specific district list that we targeted, and our number one focus was on districts who had been that had been unopposed in elections.
Right.
So that is kind of horrifying to think about, which I believe we had 25 unopposed races in our most recent Kentucky election.
Kind of surprised it was that low, actually.
Yeah, it is low, but it's still, what, about 25%?
Yeah, it's 25% of the chamber. Right, so. Absolutely, yeah. That's not uncommon. But yeah, I think that that's very smart. And that's something that the Republicans have done really well in the recent past at getting people to just run in every single district. The owner of the building we're sitting in is a big fan of running somebody in every district. So it's, you know, that, this helps to pay our rent. We're helping to support his argument.
Yes, I've read some of his pieces, actually, so I know how he feels.
All right, Ben, I hope you're listening. Okay, talk to me a little bit about the recruitment process. You know, you guys seem like, you know, you talked a lot about how you are different from the way that you recruit. What has it been like when you have pitched your ideas? Have you gotten people interested in running for something who might not have been interested before? Have you seen people more willing to step up as you've given them this kind of opportunity to be supported in their run?
We have. The great thing is we really, truly are a grassroots, on-the-ground organization. So our process has been extremely informal. It's literally just showing up to the county meetings, political meetings, Democratic Party or other interest groups, talking to people, looking for people who have connections in their communities and asking them if they're interested and what their history is and what kinds of issues they'd like to talk about. And it's been that kind of informal but really gratifying process, and it has gotten people involved. So we've already seen a few people step up in some of our targeted districts, and we've got people who are strongly considering as well.
Uh-huh.
The kinds of candidates we're really looking for are people who are vested in their communities, who want to go knock on every door and listen to what folks have to say, and who are ideological and willing to think big, but also pragmatic as well, because you have to have a balance of the two, and who just have those perspectives on some of the issues we're actually legislating on in Frankfurt. So,
right.
You know, who might actually be affected by labor laws or
yeah.
the healthcare expansion or whatever else you're talking
Absolutely.
About.
Absolutely. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Carmen, something that I found as, I guess, a card-carrying member of the political industrial complex.
And I've been a member of the KDP since I could vote, so I'm criticizing myself too.
I think, in my experience, a lot of folks don't really have a good picture of exactly how much time and effort and generally how difficult it is to run for political office, even at some of the lowest levels. I'm curious what some of those early initial conversations look like. If somebody comes to you and says, hey, I'm interested in running for office in my local state representative district. Mm-hmm. What do you end up talking to them about early on in that process?
So that is a very great point. And so something else I want to mention too is we've had a lot of support from many state representatives themselves. So Joni Jenkins and Mary Lou Marzian have been our biggest champions probably so far. And so they've been in some of those conversations with us when we're reaching out to folks. So when you think about running, just thinking about the fundraising and knowing how to talk about different issues, because even if you're passionate about healthcare, you've got to be ready to talk about the pension and just knowing how to talk to the media and all of those things are very difficult. So luckily we've had a lot of the state representatives enter those conversations with us and say, this is how you kind of get involved in the process. And that is, in the long term, one of the things we're focusing on. So we're not just recruiting people. We want to support them in all of those different endeavors as well. Mm-hmm. Getting volunteers, talking about canvassing, and holding forums where you can talk about issues is definitely part of the conversation we have. And we're ready to have it as soon as they come to us with those concerns, because we don't want people to say to themselves, you know what, I'd love to run, but I'm just not comfortable talking to a reporter, or I don't know enough about all the issues or all of those things. So we want to address all of those concerns as soon as possible.
Sure. Yeah. One thing that I think would be an interesting question is just kind of this feels almost like insurgency-like. Like it's almost like, you know, we're doing this work that hasn't been done in the past, and criticizing the fact that there's 25 open seats that nobody ran for. What has the interaction with the wider state party been, those people that are working towards recruiting the people in the political industrial complex? Do you feel like that the wider party has been supportive or, you know, questioning, hesitant, or what is your relationship with KDP been so far?
It's been very positive, actually. And you're right, there is kind of an insurgency, especially because we're our own organization doing our own thing. But they have had, of course, their own leadership changes. And actually, the new director, Mary Nishimuta, okay, great. She is friends with some of the people in our organization. And so we've had a great open dialogue between her. She includes us in what they're doing. And we have a great open line of communication as far as how to work together on recruitment instead of working in an adversary type of way.
Sure.
So with that being said, though, there has been some tension, I think, on the ground level, and it's not one party or the other. It's just recognizing, and this is true at a national level, that something has really gone wrong on the liberal, progressive side of politics because we've lost so many seats.
Yeah.
So you've seen all kinds of people try to step up to the plate and offer solutions. And so there's a tension just in figuring out what different organizations have to offer as far as strengths. So that can be anything from voter registration to talking more about issues in depth and getting out to folks, media advocacy, recruiting candidates. There's a lot of different areas we can all work together on. Mm-hmm. And so right now, because it is in the early stages, I guess, of coming off of the last election, we're all trying to figure out what that's going to look like.
Sure.
And that can bring some tension, but I think it's been a positive tension for the better. So you've seen different groups come together, different people on the spectrum. So more center people to the all the way left working together. And so I think it's been a really positive thing.
Okay, cool. So if somebody was interested in what you had to say so far, what do you think the biggest needs are in the organization? And if somebody wants to get involved in this or may want to run themselves, how can they help?
Sure. Well, we always need money. So I'm the fundraising director. I'm obligated to say that. So money always helps. But I will go beyond that and say, so the people who are interested in running themselves, of course, they can contact us directly, and we're very easy to reach. So we're on all forms of social media. Our handle is the same. It's KY Initiative on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And we have a website as well. That's kyinitiative.org. And we have a really thorough sign up or nominate sheet buttons on our website. So you can nominate yourself, nominate somebody else, or if you want to volunteer in a certain capacity, you can do that. And so what we're really looking for is a bench of people who want to support candidates.
Mm-hmm.
So beyond just finding people to run, we want people who have certain skills that they want to offer to folks.
Mm-hmm.
And so that can be designing a website or going to knock on people's doors or helping them with fundraising calls. So that's something I like to offer. I'm completely comfortable asking people for money, and I always keep getting invited to be in organizations. I have no idea why that is, but
it's a rare talent.
Yeah, that's right. You're in high demand.
Right. So that's what we're really looking for, because we want to be able to offer those resources as soon as people are ready to run. Because going back to what I said earlier, we want to get past those anxieties and have that community support. And it also helps people on the ground who feel like they're disenfranchised from the process. Mm-hmm. If you're actually being part of campaigns and you know the people in your district who are running, you have that relationship, it helps people feel more positively about the process, which can be very difficult, especially in the times we're living in.
Absolutely.
So, so they can reach out to us. We're all very easy to find through our website and social media.
Awesome. Okay. Well, Carmen, thank you so much for coming to talk to us about the initiative. I heard the big, you made it. You made it. Yeah,
right.
Well, it was good. I feel like I've learned a lot about that organization, and I hope everybody else has too. And I wish you the best of success. Are you guys ready to talk a little bit about the news?
Yes, let's do
all right.
It.
Well, you know, Robert, tax reform is just one of my favorite topics to talk about.
Hey,
oh, it's so exciting.
You can't make fun of this. This is what we do on the show. Okay, so.
I'm 100% serious.
We're going to talk now about Governor Bevin signing a budget reduction order to fix the shortfall in the budget this year. We've talked a little bit about this in shows previous, but in case you need a refresher, okay, so on July 14th, Governor Bevin closed a $152 million budget shortfall with what is called a budget reduction order. So that's essentially a way to, you know, say we have more bills, or we said we were going to spend more than we actually took in. So we need a way to bridge this gap, to reduce the amount of money that we owe. So in order to close that gap, the budget reduction order saw $77 million removed from restricted funds and placed into general operations, $55 million cut from state agencies, and $16 million transferred from other funds that had more money than expected. So, you know, obviously as a state, huge unwieldy group with lots of different revenue sources. Some did better than expected. That money was supposed to go towards one thing. They took it and they moved it into another. They cut spending from some agencies, and some money that was already sitting in a pot somewhere to be used later, they took it out of that pot and put it towards the general use of funds. Restricted funds were one of the things that they used money from. What they saw big transfers from include $15 million from what's called the Petroleum Underground Storage Tank Fund, which we have $15 million laying around to store tanks of petroleum underground.
The more you know.
Yeah, there you go. And $2 million from the Kentucky Pride Trust Fund, which is typically used for illegal dump cleanup. So I guess we're going to have more illegal dumps laying around next year because we didn't have as much revenue from sales and income taxes. The executive branch is where most of the cuts came from, which makes sense because it's much larger than the other two branches of government in terms of dollars. But the legislative branch saw about $4 million in cuts. The judicial branch was cut by about $400,000. Okay, we talked about the budget shortfall in a previous show. We mentioned the Rainy Day Fund. Are you guys familiar with the Rainy Day Fund?
If I remember correctly, Robert, it is the designated fund exclusively for the purpose of filling budget shortfalls like the one we just went through.
Oh, man.
Isn't that right?
I like it when people have answers. Yes, that is exactly what it is.
A plus.
Yeah. this is what we tap into typically when we have to fill budgets. It's supposed to be used in case of emergency. The governor's order actually did not need to tap into the shortfall to fill this fund. They were able to find money and make cuts other places. That's probably a good thing. $55 million worth of cuts were required to do this, so that's reduction in services that would have otherwise occurred. Where those cuts came from, I don't have too many details about where those cuts came from, but, you can make up your own mind as to whether or not, the state, it's better for the state to be on more sound financial footing, or it's worse for the state to have seen those types of cuts.
I think something I've heard a lot as I've been reading about this is that the governor and a lot of state legislators are very concerned about that this is going to be an ongoing problem. And there seemed to be a strong awareness that they needed to preserve this particular bucket of funding for what happens when we run into this problem the next year, or as they seem to be talking about it, unless we do something to fix the underlying issues in potentially for several years down the line.
Yeah, absolutely. So Governor Bevin has actually used this to gin up support for his special session around tax reform that he's been talking about having for a while. Louisville Democratic House members have also used this trick. This week, they released their own tax reform proposal in the Courier-Journal. That was probably the result of all this that happened. There were several Louisville, I think maybe all of the Louisville Democratic House members that pre-filed a bill that would be essentially a tax reform bill. And what their proposal would do, it caps itemized deductions at $17,500. It phases out the pension income exclusion. It reinstates the estate tax. It ensures more companies are assessed the limited liability entity tax. And it expands the sales tax to luxury services, which include like yacht clubs or something like...
I think limo rides.
Limo rides, golf course fees, those kind of things. It taxes cigarettes more heavily, and it would create an earned income tax credit. Okay, so both sides seem to be using this occasion to kind of gin up support for their tax reform proposals. Do you think that that's good politics to use this kind of shortfall to do this kind of work?
I think it's a really easy opportunity from an optics perspective, if mm-hmm. nothing else. I think most average Kentuckians aren't really intimately familiar with kind of the details of revenue funding and, mm-hmm. and general funds and the like, and I don't blame them in the slightest. But I think it's very, very easy to connect tax reform as here's how we bring money in, and then budget shortfalls as here's what's going on when the money goes out. Mm-hmm. Very easy to connect those two together from just an easy perspective. So I think I definitely understand why the various groups are doing this.
Yeah. And it's true, we have a structural budget where on an annual basis, we always are going to have less money coming in than we have budgeted money going out. And we probably need to do something about that. And not only that, we also have an upside down tax system, which relies on money from middle class and lower class people as a larger portion of their income than it does people on the higher end of the income distribution. Different people disagree as to whether or not that's fair, but it's probably not a good way to increase the amount of money. If you're asking for a higher percentage of people to have lower amounts of money, then that's calculus. You run into a limit there. Yeah, and the Democrats that pre-filed this progressive tax reform bill, okay, here's a question I have. They're all from Louisville. There aren't a lot of rural legislators who have come forward to support this plan. Do you see that as a problem? It seems like that there has been this growing kind of urban versus rural divide, and do you think that we need some support from the more rural Democratic legislators to get support for this plan, or is it just kind of doomed in the first place because it's a Democratic proposal and it's a fully controlled Republican government?
Okay, I'll jump in, although I'm sure I probably know less about this topic than you both. But I think that it's always easier to, make these big proposals on tax mm-hmm. reform when you're the minority party. So
right.
I'm sure there's kind of an expectancy from the members of the House who filed this that it may not go particularly far, especially right now. And it could just be a function of I'm always hesitant to talk about the urban-rural divide. I know it's there, but I feel like an us versus them mentality is not the best way to look at the situation, because I think that even though rural areas tend to be more conservatives, you know, conservative. I think that we've also seen the results of this great austerity experiment in Kansas. Mm-hmm. And so I think people are more willing to give a look at mm-hmm. raising certain kinds of taxes because we've seen recently kind of the disaster that can unfold when you keep spiraling towards the bottom and
absolutely.
Pushing regressive tax policies. But we just don't have the legislature to push that right mm-hmm. now. So I think that conversation is already kind of dead in the water, but I think it's more a function of this party and that party, not
right.
necessarily that we couldn't get more rural people to think.
Yeah, and this is really early on in the process. You know, these urban legislatures that brought this forward, and you know, it absolutely could be the case that all the Democrats sign on to it or something.
I think it's interesting. Something I feel that a lot of members of kind of the larger progressive community have really been pushing for is a narrative other than simply the anti-Trump narrative for the Democratic mm-hmm. Party.
Right.
So I think this is, I would have to agree with Carmen. I think the likelihood of this bill really going anywhere, certainly until the 2018 elections, is pretty slim.
Mm-hmm.
But as really staking out a position and kind of offering a very specific alternative
mm-hmm.
And a very specific policy vision for kind of what Democrats are looking to stand for, not simply as an opposition party. So I think it's a good step in that direction.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think so, too. And I think the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy did an excellent job at their conference earlier talking about how you can really change the narrative on tax reform once you get people to start thinking about what they actually fund again.
Mm-hmm.
So when you remind people it funds your schools and funds your roads and
mm-hmm.
all of these other things, then it's a lot easier to get people to say, you know what, maybe I won't be too angry if my taxes go up. But first you have to have that conversation.
Yeah.
And so that gets back again, I'll plug Kentucky Initiative again. We want candidates who will actually talk about that, not just kind of have this neutral, well, I'm for tax reform, but what does that mean?
Right.
So
yeah, and not only is KSEP really good at finding the words to use to talk about this, I feel like a lot of this came out of KSEP proposals. That's what it looked like to me. All right. Well, that's taxes. We fixed our budget shortfall for the year, I guess. There's a reduction order that happened, and we are getting ready for a tax special session, and the battle lines are drawn. All right, we're going to talk now about an ethics panelist. This is maybe more fun than tax reform. I'm not sure. Okay, in the past, we've talked about Governor Bevin's house and the ethics complaints it's generated. We've talked about this on lots of shows, and you guys are laughing because I'm sure you've heard about it everywhere you've looked. In case you need to be caught up, the governor bought a house for about $1.3 million less than what the PVA said it cost. The person who he bought it from, he appointed to be on the Kentucky Retirement Systems Board. That's the long and short of it. And there are two complaints that have been filed against him from an ethics standpoint, one of them by Richard Belisles, who works for Common Cause Kentucky, and one by Representative Daryl Owens from Louisville. When you make a complaint, the complaints are referred to the Executive Branch Ethics Commission, which has 5 members. Until last week, that panel had 3 members who were appointed by Governor Beshear. But last week, those 3 members' terms ended, and Governor Bevin appointed Tim Klein, an Owensboro attorney, before the meeting on Monday. So now there are 3 members who've been appointed by Governor Bevin and 2 that have been appointed by Governor Beshear, which probably means the ethics complaints won't get very far. Executive Branch Ethics Commission. But there's more to this story. The Executive Branch Ethics Commission did meet on Monday, and while they did not take up the complaints by Mr. Belisles and Representative Owens, they did address the possibility of a conflict of interest if the Attorney General were to investigate the governor for wrongdoing. So, you know, if the Executive Commission, you know, doesn't do much, the Attorney General could start his own investigation, use his resources to look into whether or not some foul play occurred. But the Executive Branch Ethics Commission has said in the past that investigating a, quote, political opponent is a conflict of interest, but that an attorney general can indeed investigate a governor without a conflict of interest if the attorney general does not become a gubernatorial candidate who runs against the governor in the future. So Andy Beshear, the attorney general, was asking for clarification around this point. And at their meeting on Monday, they reiterated the point, saying that unless the attorney general says that he is not running for governor, that will be a conflict of interest if he begins an investigation. So Andy Beshear's chief deputy, J. Michael Brown, was at that meeting, and he said, quote, "I think it has a chilling effect. I think you can't force somebody in that position, particularly when you don't know if there's an actual conflict or you don't know if there's any personal interest involved." Okay, so this opens up an interesting hypothetical for me. Given that it's a conflict of interest, just taking that at face value. What do you think Andy Beshear should do? So should he just like say, I'm out of the governor's race, even if he wants to run and do it because that's what an attorney general should do? Or should he, you know, say, well, you know, we're probably not going to get very far with this anyway, because what dirt could we dig up? And then what would happen if we managed to find something? There's nobody in the legislature who's going to like impeach him. So, you know, what are we going to do? What do you think?
It's a really sticky political situation for the attorney general to be in. The cynical kind of political calculus, I think, on this is, to some degree, obviously going against the wishes of the ethics commission here would be somewhat politically risky for him. I'm personally not familiar as to what the mechanisms the ethics commission has to necessarily enforce its decisions, but it certainly would not look good from the attorney general's perspective were he to pursue this investigation. At the same time, should he end up discovering or uncovering kind of some more specific tangible evidence of wrongdoing on the governor's behalf, the political calculation here could be that would be worth the cost of him taking some hits in order to reach that place. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's probably the more cynical kind of political operative perspective.
Right. Sure. Do you agree or disagree?
That sounds right to me. this is very much out of my wheelhouse, but yeah, I think Ethan's right. But what a complicated situation.
Absolutely.
Just to be in the first place.
Yeah, and we didn't even mention the fact that like Andy Beshear is Steve Beshear's son, so we have them missed.
Right.
We have
so all this of that is all. And I know earlier today, it just the Kentucky GOP Twitter feed started publishing even more stuff about Andy that I was trying to get work done, so I didn't read all the way. But it's just, I feel like his presence, whether he puts on the record that he's going to be a candidate or not, I feel like they're very determined to make a lot of noise around him being involved. So it's a complicated situation.
Yeah, I mean, I think just as a citizen of the state of Kentucky, I would like for somebody to investigate this. And I don't think the Executive Branch Ethics Commission is going to take this up. So I think that, you know, Andy Beshear, you're pretty young. You'll still be pretty young 4 years from now. Your dad was like super old when he became the governor. Like, he waited a long time. You can wait a little bit longer. You should just be like, I'm not running for governor. Let Adam Edlin do it or whatever. And, you know, open this investigation, because I really think it's important. And then, you know, maybe if you find something out, you're like, this is egregious. And you know what the solution is? I'm running for governor.
There you go.
And then what's the Executive Branch Ethics Commission is going to be like, that you said you weren't? And who cares at that point? Everybody is consumed with scandal about a $1.3 million bargain that the governor got anyway. So, okay, but there's another piece of this that I'm interested in as well. And that's, do you think the ruling itself makes sense? You know, we have here that J. Michael Brown says it has a chilling effect on people. Do you think that this makes sense? What if the shoe were on the other foot and we had, you know, a Democratic governor, an attorney general that was a Republican that looked like he wanted to run for governor, and there was something that was maybe a little shady about this Democratic governor, but, you know, may not be necessarily bad, but you're like, oh my gosh, this is clearly politically motivated, right? I mean, do you think that this is a wise ruling, or is it lacking clarity?
I think one thing to keep in mind, as we were talking earlier about the composition of the Ethics Commission, I believe, if I remember correctly, it was a 4-1 decision, so it didn't break cleanly on kind of expect the party lines to be here. That said, and full disclaimer, I'm not a lawyer, but I think setting that precedent of no attorney general could ever investigate someone that they could potentially run for office against seems to be a blanket situation that would exclude a lot of cases beyond just this.
Right. That's a good point.
It is a good point. And I was thinking in, you know, an analogous term, you know, would this apply? Like, I was thinking actually about, well, this would never be the situation, I guess, the executive branch, but just thinking about it nationally, how weird it would be if we had that conversation about Donald Trump and Jeff Sessions, maybe. Yeah. Not that I think Jeff Sessions wants to run for president, but it's very strange to have that blanket rule and say chief attorney general can't investigate ethics complaints,
right,
just because he might want to run for the office later. I just feel like I understand why you don't want that kind of open season of partisanship where you have investigations, because you could conceive of a situation where in every new term we have those kind of conflicts, but
kind
of
do anyway.
Time, it's, yeah, we do. So does it even matter, really?
Yeah, I think we're batting 1,000 in the 21st century in Kentucky whenever the attorney general and governor are in a different party that there is an investigation into that person. And Greg Stumbo actually did manage to run for governor in 2007 anyway, after investigating Governor Fletcher, lost though. So, you know. It's a complicated situation. Everything about it seems complicated, but somebody needs to do some investigating. I don't really care who it is. All right. Last in our big topics here, SACS is investigating. Okay, SACS is an acronym for the Crediting Agency at the University of Louisville. They are investigating two more potential violations by the University of Louisville. We said Ethan went to Center. I went to UK. Carmen, you actually went to U of L. That's good. We have a U of L person here to talk about this with us. I feel kind of weird talking about it as not a U of L person. So it's been a while since we checked in on this, but we talk about this all the time. In case you forgot, U of L is on probation because of the governor's decision to dismiss the entire board of trustees at the university without giving them any chance for recourse whatsoever. The legislature took steps to remedy this issue, and there was kind of hints back and forth during the legislative session that the Republicans in the state Senate were kind of working with SACS to come to a conclusion legislatively that would make this above board and take them off of probation. But SACS has been pretty quiet. They haven't said whether or not that worked or whether or not they're going to remove the probationary status from U of L. But now there is new news that SACS is investigating new issues at U of L, two of them in particular. First, that the university failed to comply with its own conflict of interest standards. The issue raised by Kate Howard at the Kentucky Center for Investigative Journalism looked into conflict of interest forms that people at boards at U of L have to fill out. Ms. Howard's piece indicated that many of the athletics boards might not have even been collecting these forms in the first place, and that many of the forms might have been incomplete or shoddily done. In fact, John Schnatter, Papa John, his form was filed after Ms. Howard's request, and it was filed retroactively. So he had actually come off the board and filed a conflict of interest about a board he'd already left after an open records request had gone through. So interesting information there.
Sounds shady to me.
Right. The second issue SACS raised was the very large number of senior administration staff who are serving on an interim basis. So the university president, the university provost, chief administrative officer, the chief financial officer, and the chief operations officer are all serving as interims over at the University of Louisville. And that's actually an incomplete list. There are other people over there who are also serving on an interim basis. So part one, the conflict of interest forms. This is kind of wild, right? I mean, after you're already on probation and there's like all this heat coming down all around you about this audit of the foundation, you know, you lost your president, you lost your provost, you lost all these people, your interim president left to take another job. Wouldn't you like be like, we got to make sure all of our I's are dotted and our T's are crossed here when we're collecting these forms because, you know, there's a lot of pressure on you. This seems kind of wild, right?
One would think.
At the same time, I feel like it seems like there are a lot of conflict of interest issues happening already. And so if one were to encounter a significant number of those issues, maybe not necessarily having all your I's dotted and T's crossed on your forms would be a reasonable consequence from that.
And also maybe the second issue that everybody in the world is in on an interim basis, they don't know where the T's and I's are to dot and cross. But I feel like conflict of interest forms are kind of a big one.
They are. And I mean, yeah, it does make you wonder how people are minding the store. And just to remind all your viewers, too, I'm not the official spokesperson for U of L. So you should not, you know, take any statement I say and say, here
yes, please
is the
don't
official.
Do that.
Yes.
None of us are official. This is not an official podcast. This is.
But I do know, actually, that faculty, of course, they have to fill these forms out. Mm-hmm. And so they have been managing to get that done mm-hmm. from the faculty members themselves. So it makes you wonder if maybe there is a bit of a double standard or, again, just the shuffling of people at the top. That's not
right.
necessarily the case at the bottom. So, you know, I have no insight either way into that, but it does make you wonder with everything else that's going on. It's just yet another thing.
Yeah. And I will say, too, I mean, I don't I made fun of Papa John for being Papa John earlier, and I don't agree with him politically on much, and I think he's kind of a weird guy. But by all accounts, he's been a very good board member at U of L on both the athletic side. I mean, he was chief among the people that was like, maybe we shouldn't put the Yum Center right on the waterfront because it's too expensive, which they did anyway. He was one of the chief people who was like, you know, let's fix some of these issues around the way that we do athletics and the costs that are associated with it. So, you know, he's done some good stuff on the boards, despite being, you know, kind of a weird person. Okay, the other piece about the interim leaders. to me, that's like adding insult to injury. That's like nobody wants to have that many interim leaders at one point. And I don't think AWUFL is like, this is on purpose. This is by design, you know. And I think by putting somebody on probation for that reason, like all you do is speed up the process by which you hire people. And it seems like, you know, they're already having some trouble. And so they might get somebody who's not right for the role. So that seems like a bad move to me by Sachs.
I wonder if this could be a part of a kind of a larger picture of kind of the particular investigation going on with Sachs and U of L right now. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of the ways that prosecutors will sometimes kind of use the charges that they might file as a way to kind of set the table for negotiations that might follow, or a plea bargain or something along those lines. That, you know, I'd be inclined to agree with you that, you know, penalizing them for making sure that the school was running even while they didn't have people in these roles long term seems a little, you know, iffy. But if they're looking to kind of piece this together in a larger picture, maybe there's some wheels turning in the background that we're not seeing at the moment.
That absolutely could be the case. Good insights, Ethan. All right, guys. Are you prepared for some quick hits? Very fast stories, one sentence each.
Let's do it.
All right, first quick hit is that Kentucky's battle between the senators appears to be over, with Mitch McConnell's health care bill seemingly dead in the United States Senate. Rand Paul has emerged victorious along with the rest of the American people, I guess. Okay, next story. White nationalist Matthew Heimbach pled guilty via an Alford plea to disorderly conduct at a Trump rally in Louisville last year, where he shoved a protester, whose name I can't pronounce. Last story. Ark Encounter LLC, the large ark in northern Kentucky. It sold its main parcel of land to Crosswater Canyons, its associated nonprofit group, in an attempt to be to prevent being assessed a safety tax, which the city and county were trying to assess on it. We need to talk more about the Ark Encounter at some point on the show. I'm going to put Jasmine in charge of that. She's gone.
Definitely worth a full episode.
All right. Carmen and Ethan, thank you guys so much for being on the show. Thank you for giving us your insights, talking to us about the initiative, and giving us all of this, the great points, Ethan. You brought the knowledge. Carmen, you also brought the knowledge. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much, Robert.
Thank you for having us, Robert.
All right, everybody. You can find us on Twitter at MyOldKYPod. You can find us on Facebook just by searching the name My Old Kentucky Podcast. You can subscribe to us in any podcasting app of your choice, and we put our show notes on Medium. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I hope you tune in next week as well. Thanks. Bye. And the meadows in the blue.